and welcome to the Ashley Webster Experience. I'm here with Brian Solomon, executive producer, and our guest today is Bert Flickinger. He is the managing director of Strategic Resource Group. It's a consumer industry business consulting firm. It's headquartered in New York City, but Bert, that doesn't tell the story. Welcome, by the way. Thanks for coming in. You are essentially the retail guru, and that sounds a bit flip because it doesn't do you justice at all, but you have spent your entire life as your father and grandfather in the retail business, how to grow the business, how to brand the business, and how to get consumers to come in and spend money. I mean, it's a basic thing, but it's not easy. Just give me a little bit of your background, Bert.
Our family came out of an orphanage, didn't even know their last name was Flickinger, and they were raised by farmers because great-grandmother died in childbirth to twins, 12th and 13th kids. So they kept their six-year-old daughter to run the house. Eight-year-old was the youngest they kept to work on the farm, and all the kids below five were put in foster homes and orphanages. And then they were told when they were 21 that their real name wasn't Prentice, the farmer's family that raised them, but Flickinger. And they got together and started a farm stand and a fruit stand. And then they were treated badly when there were no antitrust laws by AMP, which is twice as big as Walmart. So they created retail franchising, gave it away for free, and then collateralized their inventory and crops and what they had in the stores to co-finance retailers from Australia and across North America and Europe to open red and white stores first and then ultimately IGA stores.
So that all goes back to the Flickinger kids.
Yeah.
That's from such humble beginnings. It has grown remarkably. I mean, you must – I know you know the story clearly. You're one of the Flickingers, but it is remarkable.
Yeah,
it's literally the David versus Goliath story, but wasn't unique to the Flickingers, Ashley, because, you know, Procter & Gamble, which became my alma mater, but in those days, Procter & Gamble and Unilever were told not to sell the Krogers, not to sell the Flickingers, not to sell the Cullen family, which is – now selling their King Cullen chain, which is the first
of
them.
Blackballed, in other words.
and so we vertically and horizontally integrated everything from farming to food manufacturing to distribution, food stores, retail stores, and develop private label to canned tuna just to fight the antitrust.
Did you invent canned tuna?
My great-grandfather did before the Bogdanoviches who invented Starkist.
Oh, my gosh.
What a claim to fame that is. And the rest is history, as they say.
Yeah, well, he went out to visit his brother George, who he'd never met, who was given up for an orphanage. And George started the first supermarket chain in California. And it was in Southern California where all the tuna boats came in. And they couldn't keep the product fresh, and there wasn't good refrigeration. So they said they were already canning fruits and vegetables. Why couldn't they can tuna? And the rest is history.
Complete genius. And the rest is history.
That's a part of the retail fabric. Every supermarket, everyone knows that. And your family created that.
Chicken of the sea.
Yeah, right.
Chicken of the sea.
And fast forward, now they all got convicted of price fixing by the federal government because Starkist, Bumblebee, Chicken of the Sea, between the executive leadership and everything else. Instead of profitably driving demand by investing in advertising and marketing with geniuses like Milan Pollock, who was the chief creative officer of Leo Burnett that had invented Charlie the Tuna, they gave her no money to market Starkist with Charlie the Tuna. And to her credit, she and Lenora Rand said, enough of this big corporate stuff where the big brands won't invest. And they started their own agency, Small Good, and doing a tremendous job. And they're the David versus Goliath story because they couldn't do canned tuna when canned tuna should be ubiquitous and growing every year.
So let's bring this fast forward into today's world. You are on the Fox Business Network a lot talking about the retail business. I think you quoted the retail ice age. I think you were the first person to do that when we talked about the impact of people shopping online. What does it do to brick-and-mortar stores? How much has the landscape changed in the retail industry?
Landscape's changed, Ashley, with record number of retail chain bankruptcies, record number of store closures. There were 12,000 store closures, as you've referenced earlier on Fox Business Network. In 2018, there'll be even more bankruptcies and store closings in 2019. And it's a combination of ineptitude by the federal bankruptcy judges and then ineptitude by the many of the private equity owners who leave the retailers undercapitalized with less capable people that the private equity firms. And also U.S. is overstored because of cheap financing and cheap debt. We're 400% overstored and moving to 150% overstored, hence the retail ice age.
And then I think of the 80s, it was the decade of the mall, wasn't it, where everyone used to go catch a movie, hang out with friends in the coffee shop, the food courts and all that. That's all gone. There's so many ghost malls out there right now. And I just noticed that Amazon is starting to move in and trying to perhaps convert some of these into warehouses, but they've been converted into high schools, businesses, churches even. I saw one down in Florida. I mean, it's a real change, but there are still so many malls out there gathering dust and you know, going decrepit, if you like. I mean, these used to be the center of the communities.
Malls were the center of the community. And what's underreported is we're going through the second cycle. John Rothschild wrote this seminal book called Going for Broke when Bob Campo came from Canada, bought dozens of department stores, ran them all into bankruptcy with too much debt. Now we're going through the second cycle. But even with Amazon, the Whole Foods guys really, in my professional view, really got greedy with price gouging, people who couldn't afford to shop in their stores. We thought ray of sunshine that Amazon would buy Whole Foods and transform it. Full disclosure, I and my team did the due diligence for 14 months, U.S., Canada, and across America, and the Whole Foods acquisition for the first buyer that was outbid by Amazon. But we were glad that Amazon was coming in. Fast forward to last week with Butch Castellani, go to Niagara Falls Boulevard, talk to the Dean of Architecture and Development, University of Buffalo. Whole Foods, Amazon bulldozed one of those great department stores and malls you talked about, hundreds of thousands of square feet, built a normal size Whole Foods, Amazon store. Store's supposed to do $1.25 million a week. They're doing less than 200,000 because the entrepreneurial families that came out of farms and one store, Colleen and Danny and Nicole Wegman at Wegman's, to Joe Dash and his family and the Pernas and a number of others. It's the David versus Goliath story. Yeah. The retailers that take care of the customers and have the most competitive prices and the best product win. And then I don't know if it's Jeff Bezos's divorce, which seems to be distracting him and in my professional view. But when you've got a one man running the show like Bezos, the wealthiest, in my view, probably the smartest guy who's ever worked in retail, when he's going to the show, as we've talked pre-broadcast, your producer, Brian and I, when Bezos is going to the show instead of running the show, when he's acquired all these other businesses and he can't pay attention to the detail of retail and the rhythm of retail, his store of the future is falling apart. So his business is up 18.8%, which is great for the quarter that Amazon just reported, but it should be up 25%. And the retail ice age is really affecting Amazon because you make one mistake and it's so unforgiving that even Amazon, with its great progress, is going backwards in bricks and mortar
and
retail.
I feel like that the marriage, there's been a lot of friction, hasn't there, between Whole Foods and Amazon. Mm-hmm. Whole Foods, as you say, was at a certain level. It was kind of a snob appeal. It was high-end stuff, expensive. Amazon comes in, tries to streamline the operation, change things, try to generate money in different ways, and it really has put the cat among the pigeons at Whole Foods.
I love the way you synthesize it, cat amongst the pigeons, because Whole Foods had an obtuse board, no term limits. The co-founder, John Mackey, never gave proper credit, in my professional view, to Peter Roy and Walter Robb, the seminal geniuses that built Whole Foods with the others. And for all his brilliance in the first 25 years, you know, he got to be his own fat cat. And, you know, people with a family of five with three young kids couldn't afford to pay $5,000 more at Whole Foods versus what they were paying at Wegmans or Winco or somewhere else.
So where do we go with Amazon? It's a behemoth, and it's spreading its tentacles out in many different directions. It could get into banking and who knows
what.
Healthcare, airlines. I don't know where they're going to go next. They're going to buy their own, you know, cargo planes, I'm sure, to try and cut out the high cost of the, you know, the delivery services. But they can go in any direction. Is that good or bad?
It's good that Amazon can go in any direction because they're doing a lot to raise shoppers' standard of living by lowering prices to consumers. Our fear is that, you know, the Federal Trade Commission hasn't investigated anybody in over 27 years for predatory pricing, anti-competitive practices. Amazon should be investigated. Full disclosure, long-term shareholder of Amazon, happy, but want to do the right thing. And they should be investigated. At the same time—
Investigated for what?
Predatory pricing, anti-competitive practices.
And how do they do that?
Just classic example is the Hachette lawsuit of brutal buying practices for Hachette books and driving the book prices lower and then doing what Professor Ken Stone at Iowa State and his great work said Mr. Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart, did was Walmart would lower prices to everybody from the food store, the drug store, the discount store, the department store went out of business. And then wherever Walmart wiped out Main Street, Walmart would raise the prices to the people left to the point they couldn't afford it. And the Federal Trade Commission, given that Walmart's been one of the largest campaign contributors to both Bushes, both Obamas, both Clintons, they've had all kinds of air cover in Washington for over 25 years, and Amazon's had a lot of air cover with government giveaways and no antitrust investigation, so any retailer knows it can get away with whatever it wants because it doesn't matter if the Federal Trade Commission's chaired by either party. They just want to go back into private practice when they rotate off the FTC or the Department of Justice. So consumers and communities, to your great point of the ghost malls, the taxpayers have to pay for the ghost malls because Sears in Hamburg near that Whole Foods, when they defaulted, a mall that was worth $55 million is going bankrupt, not even worth $15 million. But the Frontier Central School System, 78,000 students of all ages are where the Buffalo Bills play. They're dependent on that sales tax revenue that Amazon hasn't paid for years until recently. And with these ghost malls that you're presently pointing out, that sales those sales tax dollars and your listeners and taxpayers have to pay higher school taxes, but they also have to pay for the pension plans on defined benefits for the millions to tens of millions of workers that get blown out when these retailers in the ghost malls close.
So what can the brick-and-mortar guys do? You travel around the country extensively and outside the country for that matter, but you must see examples of this is how you take on the Amazons. What can you give the consumer that they can't get on Amazon?
The best thing is creating one's own products and something really unique. So you look at who's winning when the rest of retail is losing. Jeff Brotman, Jim Senegal, my teammate from Procter & Gamble, Mike Parrott, who's head of merchandising for Costco, always the treasure hunt. Costco, no matter what Amazon does, very positive same store comparison sales everywhere in the world. Chris Baldwin, who was a great leader on our Procter & Gamble team, went to Hess Retail, turned it around. He passed on the priesthood, much to his mother and grandmother's disappointment as the youngest son, when he came out of Siena College in the Albany area. It's a great superstar, but he's a real inspirational leader. So at BJ's, new products, new services, like you said with Amazon, there's BJ's.com. But consumers are most motivated on price because in their 10 key monthly budget areas, everything's going up from rent to transportation to insurance to student debt, et cetera.
Right.
So they know they can go to BJ's and Costco, save time, save money. They know they can go to off-price, Ollie's Bargain Stores, this closeouts, or the off-price retailers, Ben Camerata and Carol Meyerowitz, the great job they did at TJX.
If you're sitting on the sofa in your bunny slippers and you've got a laptop and you're sitting there, you don't have to get in a car and be bothered to go and fight mm-hmm. traffic. And, you know, you can just click and someone will deliver it to you. And if you're a Prime member, you'll probably get it for free shipping.
Ashley, you're bringing up the key point that's so concerning in this new year of 2019 and going forward. I also teach at Cornell University, so we surveyed students worldwide. And to your point, 50% of the students in the last month of the 2018 semester said they don't even go into a retail store.
50%.
50%.
Is that an age thing? Because when I was in college, I never did. But ever since I've graduated, I never shop online, especially for household things or groceries. I go to the grocery store. Maybe that's because I live in Manhattan. I don't know. But is that a factor of age, college age?
Age is a big part, to your point, Brian. So these are students undergrad and grad between 17 to 25 from the People's Republic of China to Arabia to Australasia, Europe, Russia, the Americas. 50% of them did not go into a store last year, and of those, half of them do almost all their buying exclusively on Amazon.
You know, the apartment building I live in here in Manhattan, the concierge guys, all they do all day is deal with packages from Amazon, 150, 200 a day. And if it's clothing or shoes or whatever it is, often they'll try them on. No, it didn't quite fit right. So back goes the same box, has to be repurposed. It's a never-ending cycle. And it's not just that. It's food, too. The amount of people. I don't think anyone's turned an oven on in my apartment building for years. Right. It's just a constant stream of people delivering food. It's the way people live these days.
Mm-hmm. And here's the ultimate irony to your and Brian's important points. Is Sears, which is likely liquidating in the near future, they had one of the great geniuses, Kurt Avalon, who ran a strategic bombing wing for the Air Force, worked his way through both Harvard and Harvard Business Schools as a blue-collar kid's stocking Stop and Shop store shelves. And he was chief merchant of Sears, and he and Max and Jose at Takeoff Technologies came up with roboticized mechanized retail that Brian knows well. And it's a checkmate strategy against Amazon. So you can do regular bricks and mortar retail, whether it's food, drug, discount, dollar, and in 8,000 square feet, generate about $1 million a week through these mechanized roboticized either e-delivery, to your point, on apartments, or click and collect. So people can pick up the general merchandise and the shelf-stable products and pick out his or her own produce and fresh fish, et cetera. And any retailer can pick up Takeoff Technologies, which Knapp has taken to scale in Europe. And in 2018, they had only five stores in the U.S., and at the FMI, Food Marketing Institute convention in Miami last week, they had 25 CEOs go through their Sedanos prototype store in Miami, got orders for 85 new mechanized, roboticized micro-fulfillment centers across America. So Amazon has this great first-mover advantage where all three of us thought Amazon was a light year ahead a year ago. Now through Takeoff Technologies. But the big story is really Walmart, where they went from family-owned and operated in the genius of Mr. Sam Walton from 62 to 1992 when he passed. His hand-picked successors ran the company well, and then his son, Rob Walton, who was a lawyer, ran it like a lawyer, which was into the ground from about 2000 to 2015. Their stock price reflected it because it was the worst performing stock in the Dow. Fast forward to Doug McMillon from Jonesboro, Arkansas, which is dirt poor area where Johnny Cash's brother died from a farm accident because there's no hospital within 100 miles. Now New York Institute of Technology is putting one in 20 years later. But Doug McMillon knows the hard work, and he ran Walmart worldwide where Rob Walton was running everything in the U.S. Bad board, in my view. McMillon comes back to the U.S., hires Dave Criscione, who of all the Cornell Summer Executive Program students I taught, Dave was one of the best in the world. Mm. Dave's running Amazon Go. Bezos is distracted. Mm. What does Doug McMillon do? First, he hires Mark Lurie, who did all Amazon, Zappos, etc. Mark Lurie's now running Walmart.com in the Silicon Valley, hires Dave Criscione. Now what Walmart's doing in terms of their 1999 store in Avon, Colorado, where they've got a FedEx in there, Mark Lurie said a few weeks ago that he'll be able to deliver to 90% of consumers in the U.S. from a Walmart e-retail facility.
So they've really picked up their game. I mean, for so long, you alluded to it earlier, that Walmart was always the bully in the neighborhood, was running mom-and-pop stores out of business. And then all of a sudden, now they're the ones taking on the big bully, which is Amazon.
Yeah, exactly as you're synthesizing it so well, Ashley. And on the other side, you've talked to a lot of the union leaders across the U.S. and Canada, and they've gotten tremendous. Amazon and Walmart have gotten tremendous government giveaways at the federal, state, and local level, and told the union leaders, you know, you can support the Democrats all you want, but like Connie Leva, who was head of one of the UFCW locals in Southern California, she saw the Democrats weren't getting it done. She ran for state senator, got elected. She'll challenge Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein to do what's right for the workers, the citizens. Mm-hmm. So you could be non-union and win. You could be union and win. But the Democrats, the union leaders, and we haven't been able to get any other news organizations to pick it up. But Frank, what the union leaders said is that 98% of union rank and file members voted for President Clinton both times, voted for President Obama both times, and 41% of them voted for President Trump against Hillary Clinton this time. Because the rank and file, even though the unions are funding the Democrats, the rank and file believe 41% from 2% voting for Republicans because they feel that their own party is betraying them at a local and national level.
So President Trump has spoken about, you know, the big business and especially Amazon. And I think it's inevitable, right, that something's going to happen to them, whether it's EU regulation, because the EU is usually the first one to come out with regulations. Could be President Trump. Maybe he strips away their U.S. Postal subsidies and all that kind of stuff. Or is it some type of antitrust? But then I wonder, because it seems like compared to the Standard Oils and the AT&Ts, don't they have a smaller market share in the retail industry?
That's a good point. And also, Bert, just to pick up on what Brian's saying, it's not like we're paying more because of the monopoly. They're driving prices lower, and it's harder to get that antitrust.
How do you fight that?
Across the line, so to speak, because we're paying less.
That's the key, Ashley, exactly as you're saying, is that Walmart drove prices lower in the last quarter of the 20th century. Amazon's driving prices lower the first quarter of this century. And to your and Brian's points, though, the one thing, you know, it's like the pass at Thermopylae of the Spartans versus the Persians. Amazon's going to get to the point where, like you said, so accurately, 200 deliveries a day. There aren't enough Federal Express and UPS and postal trucks to deliver it that much longer, and there's a shortage of drivers across the country. So one of the things we're seeing in retail is Professor Neil Matson and Dean Catherine Boer and Professor Lou Albright at Cornell are doing indoor farming because they know that there has to be urban agriculture for fresh food, because 3 years ago, to get a truck from Salinas, California to Philadelphia costs $2,500. And now that same truck, $6,500
wow.
one way with no drivers. And Amazon's facing that problem, as is all the other clicking.
What about driverless trucks? That's the big thing of the future,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
It's the autonomous semis.
Yeah,
that can help it. But also Uber Freight, right? Uber Freight seems like, you know, they're prepared to fill that void of the lack of truck drivers, right? Because
yeah.
now you could just click on your phone and they could take stuff. Maybe not, you know, huge hauls, but they could ship anything you need now.
Brian, you're completely correct. And Uber Freight fills a big void in terms of local, less than 25 mile delivery radius,
mm-hmm.
and regional within 100 to 200 miles. So that'll take the pressure of some of the long distance drivers and provide more opportunities, because trucking wages are some of the best wages out there. And it's interesting because like Stuart Varney, who hitchhiked around the world and
yeah.
traveled the world 3 to 4 times, every continent, every key country before he went to London School of Economics and came here. Just traveling as you've done so extensively, Ashley, and Brian and Neil Cavuto and your team, that's the best way to learn the markets and learn the opportunities. And it's really what Bob and Peggy Wegman did, is these private equity people and the analysts, they're all looking out the same skyscraper windows in Midtown Manhattan, a few blocks from here. But Bob and Peggy Wegman, God bless them, but you know, you'd go to their stores and they'd say they would be in the stores 200 days a year, including many Saturdays, Sundays, and it's not, hi, how are you? They're there 12 to 14 hours, and they're not meeting with the leadership right away.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking to all the part-timers. What can we do better? What are Wegman's consumers for Dr. Edward Deming, principles of total quality, continual improvement? And then they institutionalize that throughout the family with Bob's son, Danny, and then Colleen and Nicole, who are running the family, all the way to Norman and Calvin Main, who are running Dorothy Lane Markets in a share group partnership with the Wegmans. And that detail, the Wegmans knew every – Bob and Peggy and Danny, Colleen, Nicole, know every full-timer, tens of thousands of people by their first name. Bob,
that's very unusual.
In his 80s, knew half the people's names. And they institutionalized everything they did from their store visits to CBL or computer-based learning. So to your point, retail ice age, but when you have great leadership and
it
great innovation, you're always winning.
And I think Brian kind of alluded to it earlier. I mean, I like to go to shops, you know. I mean, I physically want to pick something up, because you can tell whether it's the quality you think it is, whether the fit's different, whatever it be. Do retailers new – brick-and-mortar retailers, do they need to do a better job of making that experience unique?
Make it unique, and as you were saying pre-broadcast, you're traveling back and forth to London, and as you see from Selfridges, which is one retailer of the year 3 years in a row.
I just went in there literally a week ago.
Fantastic retailer.
Fantastic.
Owned by the Weston family that developed President's Choice, so everything from food and Shoppers Drug to Selfridges. And then Harvey Nichols is doing a fantastic job with digitization of every department. So every young consumer, it's like an iPhone or watching Disney on any mobile device. So that's bringing customer counts in and, you know, go across the hyper
section. But it's an experience, too.
Experience, and then Harrods is doing nothing.
No.
To reinvest.
Nothing.
So Harvey Nichols with their innovation in London, but that hasn't been mirrored and built on by retailers in the States.
Well, that costs more money, right? So if I'm a brick and mortar and I'm losing money to the Amazons and the other internet giants, now I have to spend more money on an experience for when you come in. So that's even more money leaving, correct?
More money for the experience. You're absolutely right, Brian. But they could get their fashion resources and suppliers to fund a lot of it. And the irony is, with all the genius of Bob Pittman in Clear Channel Outdoor and the others at J.C. Dechow and Out Front, which is CBS, as they've digitized the world, starting with South Korea and now globally with digital images in every metro stop, every highway, they haven't digitized retail. So it's a great experience when people are commuting visually and informatively. But other than Harvey Nichols in London and the leading retailers in South Korea and Japan, the U.S. retailers can be very obtuse, as are their industry associations, so they don't take the best ideas from around the world.
They seem to be slow to react.
Yes.
slow to react and then have to scramble to catch up. I guess we know what the landscape has changed to, but where are we going? Is Amazon going to have a legitimate competitor down the road here? I know Walmart's done much better in taking on Amazon, but it's still a behemoth. Mm-hmm. I mean, where are we going?
It's a combination of Amazon, Walmart/Jet.com, the David versus Goliath story of Takeoff.com, working with the major regional chains across America and Europe and elsewhere. But it's also going to be the family-owned and operated leaders. And if you look at, you know, whether it's TJX, which is, you know, it's TJ Maxx and Marshall's, or whether it's BJ's or Costco or Walmart, anybody, Harvey Nichols, Selfridges with the Western Organization, Canada, worldwide, where Pack and Save in New Zealand, which is given Woolies or Woolworths and everybody fits. Wherever you've got great leaders, you've got great innovation. And like you said, people will want to come into the shops and they'll tell their friends. And when the people from the People's Republic of China come to New Zealand, now Pack and Save's doing a million a week.
Good
just
grief.
With the Chinese national shipping safe products from baby powder and formula and baby food to all these other packaged goods, because they don't trust the manufacturing and the quality control. So whether it's Wegmans or Weston or Winco, that trust of quality, safety, as well as service, taking care of the customer. People can win online and in-store, and Macy's too. Macy's.com, as you know, is seventh largest retailer in the world, and they'll be the net consolidator on land as well.
Well, it seems like during the, you know, the big financial crash and all that, the people that, you know, survived were the large sellers that could keep costs low, right? The Amazons, the Walmarts, right? And then the super luxury brands, right? The Louis Vuittons, right? The Tiffany's. You know, a lot of those companies were able to survive. Are we going to see more polarization in retail, where that middle bracket, you know, I guess you can even say, I mean, like the Macy's of the world, are those going to start dying out more and more and just have polarization of, you know, sell a lot for a low cost or sell very few for a high cost?
That's a perfect point, Brian, in terms of polarization, because you will have luxury, high-end, especially with oil markets correcting. We see the shopping from people who have the petrodollar fortunes from the Middle East or Russia or elsewhere, Brazil. They'll spend $100,000 an hour in their families in the leading department stores in the gateway cities. U.S., Europe, Bon Marché, Rive Gauche, Paris, and Printemps, Selfridges, et cetera. And people are more motivated on price than ever before, because the cost of living's getting higher, and the opportunity in terms of savings, the stock market, Fox Business News, power to prosper. To your credit, you help people make a lot of money, but a lot of the other networks don't have that focus on the individual and institutional investor. So there is the polarization between the middle and high end, and Macy's is kind of in the intersection, because they have Off Price with Backstage, as you know, they have Bloomingdale's, they have International, their partnership with their great partner ATG or Altair Group. as well as the Macy's stores doing very well. And now they're the number – they'll be the number one toy retailer this year because they have Lego full
line. Plus Toys R Us are no longer around.
Yeah. All the key Toys R Us suppliers, to Ashley's point, are now at Macy's. So some of the – and Kohl's is really capitalizing on toys. So some of the retailers in the middle will win. Mm-hmm. But you're right. There's a real business barbell between low price, off price, and luxury. And your great insight, the middle seems to be the no man's land, which is where to worry.
But what I'm hearing from you, Bert, is that what's critical to the success of any retailer has to be the management. Because they make a wrong step, or they're too slow to react, or they just don't have that vision, it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah, it's management, exactly right, Ashley. But it's also the brand suppliers worldwide. In addition to having free elephant rides when we opened stores for little kids, more importantly, we had a rule that advertising as a percent of sales should always be at least 2 to 2.5%. Now that, in my professional view, the McKinsey's of the world and the big consulting firms are saying cut advertising down to the bone. And we're also seeing the brand suppliers do that. So Kraft under Warren Buffett or Kraft Heinz, Unilever, et cetera. So we like the Michel Roux model. He went to Bill Tragos at TBWA and said, "I've got a vodka. It's unfiltered. Shenley and Smirnoff is actually cleaner, smoother. I've got a distinctive taste. I don't have anything else." Bill Tragos said, "Always invest 4% of your sales, no matter how high they get, back into advertising, consumer communication, and brand building." And the absolute story was the perfect example, and it gets to what you're saying on management. Mm. Management, it's like Chelsea Clinton coming out of Harvard Business School as a Baker Scholar after riding around in limousines all the time. What's she going to tell management when she was working for McKinsey about marketing? And so you've got all these Mensa Society MBAs who moronically know nothing about management, leadership, and marketing and brand building, and the people who hire from the state colleges and the land grant and the agriculture colleges and universities, they're the ones that win, like Cargill hiring Greg Page out of University of North Dakota and, all the state colleges. They're the ones with the most CEOs, the best retailers, most managers, and Harvard Business School, Yale, that I-95.
They all come out with theories.
Privileged people,
yes.
Right, theories.
But they haven't been on the ground.
Yeah, like you're saying, Ashley, the Yale professor who gave the future CEO of FedEx a C-, saying that the FedEx paper he submitted at Yale Business School was absurd, and Fred Smith went to prove it. To your point, management, leadership, insights, and hard work, and like Herb Kelleher with Southwest Airlines, shoulders rolled up, throwing the luggage, loading the planes, gassing them up, talking to the pilots, serving the peanuts with the flight attendants. That's the kind of leadership and management you need that we're not seeing enough of in the world today.
You know, Ashley, it's – every time I talk to Bert, whenever he comes on the show, I always speak to him. It's unbelievable how many companies and how many people in the retail world he knows. I'm always astonished.
It's remarkable.
I bet you can throw three companies at him randomly, and he'll be able to tell you about them.
Wow.
Give him three. Can you do that?
Procter & Gamble. You used to work at Procter & Gamble, didn't
you? 11 years.
What are your thoughts?
It's interesting, and is you and Brian and Stuart put together yesterday, the day after the Super Bowl, some of the most wretched advertising between their agencies with the horror show figure for Olay, which is supposed to be a beauty product,
right,
and making people feel better, and all the ways to original legacy P&G brands like Pringles. you know, it doesn't do anything to drive consumer demand. So it's with Jerry Delafamina, who wrote the book about Japanese taking over the auto industry, called mm-hmm. The Same People That Gave Us Pearl Harbor. And Jerry runs Delafamina Advertising, one of the great advertising geniuses, worked his way up from the streets of Brooklyn in the mailroom. He said, why, with this horrible advertising on the Super Bowl, why would anybody spend $5 million? Mm-hmm. He told all his clients not to spend money because you drive demand from the bottom up, understanding the consumer, knowing the competitor.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he said that's what Procter & Gamble, they're getting a little bit better, but mm-hmm. they lost it in their 100th anniversary in 1979, when their market shares were 300% higher than they are today, with wow. all the Yale and I-95 and MBAs from Yale, Princeton, Penn, and Harvard.
All right, another name for you. I lived in Nashville for 10 years. Great local store. I say local store. They're everywhere. Kroger.
Kroger, when you were there, run by one of the women I find in retail are typically mm. smarter than the men. So Marnette Perry was running the Delta region in Nashville when you were there.
Yeah.
Saw them having great success. Took Cecil's in Memphis, run into bankruptcy by three other retailers after the Cecil family sold it. Marnette turned it around. Unionized operator, could compete with anybody, union or non-union, by great leadership, supporting the local mm-hmm. farmers, the local food and beverage manufacturers. And Kroger under Dave Dillon, who in my view was the finest CEO in any format of retail worldwide, just had the best and the brightest and got the greatest ideas from everybody. And did it perfectly. He's right ahead of Frank Blake, who didn't come out of retail, but I remember it was almost exactly 10 years ago today, and was trying to turn it around after Bob Nardelli moved on to Chrysler. And he said, my agency just raised my ad budget 5%, and our sales aren't growing. What do I do? I said, A, your agency's absurd because you just had a presidential election, so they should give mm-hmm. you a 10% decrease in advertising costs. They want to run TV commercials so they can get 100% commission the first 100 days of the year in case you cut advertising
right.
for business
to
reasons.
To cover themselves.
Said, you don't need you need Fox Business TV, the number one rated shows, but you also need Fox Radio and the other radio networks. Because drive time weather, drive time traffic, drive time news, drive time business news, where people get the facts. And Frank did what he calls a hard rudder right, and he and his Home Depot team completely turned it around by changing their advertising mix, which P&G still failed to do, but Kroger did it well, to your point. Mm. Home Depot did it well. Same year I spoke with David Plouffe, President Obama's campaign managers, co-featured speakers, chief marketing officer, global awards. Mm-hmm. The Lowe's people were dancing on the table saying, Frank Blake wasn't a retailer, you know, we're bearing him. We're uh-huh. increasing our share with women, pros, contractors, men. And now you look at Lowe's, Home Depot completely turned the tables.
They're
Lowe's.
Not dancing now.
To Lowe's had to hire some of Frank's great leaders, Joe McFarland in operations and merchandising, in addition to Marvin Ellison, Home Depot legacy alums, to turn Lowe's around when Lowe's was laughing at Home Depot 10 years ago.
But
it's management leadership, like you said.
That's exactly right. You are a walking encyclopedia. No one knows this industry more than you, inside and out.
It's in his blood.
And it's in his blood, for sure. Well, we know that. We're almost out of time, but I guess my final question is, how do you shop? Do you do a lot of shopping online?
I do it all. So we test drive every online retailer and go to stores. And what we like to do in the stores is what we call the second and third shift work. When we're obviously there during daylight hours, but we want to see the back of the stores, the loading docks, all the things that's going right and wrong, what's happening on night crew, what's happening on holidays. So during the holidays, I work 17 days straight with our team, seven days a week, two and a half, you know, quote unquote shifts, or 17 to 20. Well, you know, if we're teaming up with you on Black Friday, you know, all of us have been up for like 35 hours straight. But it's the detail of retail. And my grandfather, Bert Flickinger Sr., dropped out of Harvard when the Woodrow Wilson refused to go into World War I and joined the French Army Ambulance Corps to take the wounded and the dying from the Western Front. And I asked him, I said, Grandpa, why'd you do that? He said, the horror of people getting killed, and you have to learn from all the bad things, all the good things. You, Brian, your network, you're always educating and teaching people, and that's what we learn, lifelong learning. And it starts the stores to the farms to the factories to the drivers and all the blue-collar people. That's why you're number one, and the blue-collar people, to Brian's point, voted for the president for the first time because they felt betrayed by the Clintons. So it's that lifelong learning. Bill Clinton, in my view, is one of the smartest people in government ever born, but he learned, but from personal experience, no, from trying to save a number of bankrupt retailers in New York State. Hillary Clinton was one of the most arrogant people and wouldn't even write letters to the Federal Trade Commission when asked to save bankrupt. And so thousands of families with full-time jobs and benefits got thrown into the streets as five of the top 10 retailers with operations in New York State were there. Mm-hmm. She did not have lifelong learning. And as my grandfather told me, from the Western Front in Europe and beating the Germans the first time, you see the horrors, you try to help, you try to stop. And it's really what Coach Doug and Louise Dara do at Cordell. Those scholarships, all these kids coming from the farms, you know, between equipments and skates, they're paying $100,000 a year, leading the Canadian and U.S. team to Olympic and gold medals, contending for the national championship. But like Hall of Fame coach Richie Moran in lacrosse, who wrote, "It's great to be here," and the Dara said, outwork everybody every second, every corner, every meter, every centimeter of the ice, forecheck, backcheck, what they learned from NCAA D1 coach Ned Harkness, only guy to win NCAA championships, two sports, hockey and lacrosse, at two universities. Just outwork, learn, adjust. And you saw it so brilliantly as you commented on what Bill Belichick did in the Super Bowl 2 days ago. Is here's a humble kid, son of a football coach, carrying a clipboard, going to the Naval Academy. Nobody will hire him. But Bill Belichick, lifelong learning, as he and others have taught us all, is what always works, with leadership and care and compassion for people that don't get care and compassion always from government and private equity and these big firms trying to put working people on the streets.
What a great place to finish right there, Bert. Beautifully said. It's been an absolute pleasure having you today. You have so much knowledge. You could probably write 100 books and still have much, much more to say. But we really appreciate you being here today, and we hope you come back and keep us updated on what's going on out there in the retail world.
Love to team up, and hope you get Jerry Delafamina and, you know, Coach Doug and Louise Dara,
yes.
Coach Moran, because in terms of lifelong learning, you know, starting with nothing, and their players starting with nothing, and now they're leaders of the leading networks and organizations and corporations around the world with what they've learned working their way up.
But thank you so much
again for being here today.
I'm Ashley
thank
Webster,
you.
Along with Brian Solomon. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.